This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and I want to say welcome to all our listeners. And this is going to be an important program, so get comfortable and listen up. If you've been following our website, you know that it's called Climate Gate. It's also been referred to as the final nail in the coffin of anthropogenic, meaning human-caused, global warming. The elite global leaders are pretending that nothing has happened at all and are continuing their march towards the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen starting the second week of December. And basically the storm began with just four cryptic words. A miracle has happened, announced a contributor to climateaudits.org. RC said nothing more but included a web link that took anyone who clicked on it to another site, Real Climate. There on the morning of November 17th, they found a treasure trove, about 1,000 or so emails sent or received by Professor Phil Jones. He's the director of the Climate Research Unit, the CRU, at the University of East Anglia in Norwich, England. And Jones is a key player in the science of climate change. His department's databases on global temperature changes and his measurements have been crucial in building the case for global warming. What those emails suggest, however, is that Jones and many of his colleagues have been twisting the numbers, faking the data, and withholding data in order to give more credence to the theory of global warming. And there's so much data in these emails that have been released, and new things are being found every day. It's impossible for one person to go through it all in a hurry. But you can go there and search for yourself, search for information within the emails. There's many different sites who have replicated these emails, but one of these is eastangliaemails.com, where you can go for yourself and search in these emails. And we are going to discuss this and much more today with our guest, Tim F. Ball, who joins us from Canada. We are going to talk about the scandal in Scandinavia. This has to do with the Nobel Peace Prize given to Al Gore and the IPCC. We are going to talk about COP15 or COP15. This is the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, again starting the second week of December. Just briefly here about Tim. He has a Bachelor of Arts degree from University of Winnipeg, a Master of Arts degree from the University of Manitoba in Geography, and a PhD degree in Climatology from the University of London. He heads the Natural Resource Stewardship Project and is the former head of Friends of Science. So with that, welcome to the program, Tim Ball. Very nice of you to join us today.
Well, thank you very much. And since we want to get accuracy here, just let me say that the NRSP is defunct. It's gone because we simply couldn't get funding to maintain it. But other than that, I really appreciate your introduction.
Okay, excellent. Good to clear that up, Tim. Okay, Climate Gate. There's so much to talk about, and I do want to get into this most recent thing in regards to basically how the science of global warming now seems to go down all the time, as it were. Please, Tim, give us your take on the story and tell us what has happened for those who don't know yet.
Okay, I've watched this evolve. I knew what was going on, but I couldn't put the finger on it. And as you know, with any scandal they talk about, like with Watergate, you needed the smoking gun. These emails provide that. But I want to say at the outset that this should be a period of great victory for me and vindication because I've suffered such attack. But sadly, I don't feel that at all. It's a very, very sad day for science and for the world because this is unquestionably the biggest scandal in human history. And I say that without hyperbole, because it has created global policies on energy, economy, and everything else, and all of it based upon completely falsified data. So there is no pleasure in this, and as I knew all along, there would be no pleasure in I told you so. You're absolutely correct that the volume of information, I mean, the emails themselves are devastating. They're more devastating than most people understand when they read them. Now, the people can pick out the obvious criminality, the clear statements about deleting records, falsifying records, altering records. But there's far more to it than that. And just as an illustration, one of the key issues with Steve McIntyre, who was the guy who first questioned the validity of the hockey stick, and we can get into to that, but he has always sought the code. That is, how were the computer programs written, not only for the computer models, but for the analysis of the data that they were doing? And, of course, they've consistently refused to release these codes. And now we're getting computer experts, computer programmers, looking at the code. And, of course, in the code, they can't hide what they're telling the model to do, how they're telling it to drop this data, insert this data to achieve the result that they want. So this is just an illustration of what's gone on. And as I mentioned, it was a smoking gun. In fact, it's an atomic bomb. And the great outrage is the silence that is deafening from the mainstream media. I understand how the people that are the culprits in this, for them, it is a catastrophe because they're exposed, as I said, of perpetrating this great crime, and their careers are completely finished. And of course, we know from the work in psychology that people deal with catastrophes in a sequence. That is, that first there's shock, and then there's anger, and then there's denial. And of course, that's the phase that they're in. Eventually, they will be forced to face up to the reality. But in the meantime, as you mentioned in your intro, they're in the phase that does them the most damage. That is the cover-up phase. And so this is the implications of the ClimateGate issue. And it's almost like, and I don't like to use this analogy in a sense, but it's what is referred to as the big lie. That is, the bigger the lie you tell, the more people will believe it, because they'll say, well, I can't believe that somebody would do that or say that or try to get away with that. And I think that that's why a lot of people are not coping with the issue.
So, Tim, what about if we just clear this off the table first? I mean, for a while there was speculation that we can't even confirm if the emails are fake or not. There might be data in here which someone has written up themselves, so to speak, in order to throw some mud at the climate change group, so to speak, here. But that seems to be out the door now, and it seems that even people within who has been corresponding and so forth have been coming back and saying, yeah, it is indeed true. Isn't that right, Tim?
Yes, well, there's a couple of issues with that. One is, yes, that one of the things that we've got to talk about is not only did they set up the CRU, but it's also their followers who acted as a henchman to protect them. And one of the groups that I think you refer to, RC Real Climate, in your intro, there is an email from Gavin Schmidt, who was the prime author of that, where he said, look, we're setting up this website, and basically it's to run a guard for you and really to do the dirty work for you. And they were the ones that were putting out this, oh, well, you know, this is a hacker and you can't believe this is phony. But again, the minute I saw the emails, I knew that they were real. As I said, if you've been involved with this, and I tell you, if a hacker did it, this is the most incredibly clever person in the history of the world, because the volume of data, to get the tone of these people and when they write, because as you know, there's a very distinctive fingerprint to people's work. It's like you listen to Mozart, you know it's Mozart. And so the same is true of these people. And the minute I read these emails, I can almost unfailingly say, oh, well, that's from so-and-so or that's from so-and-so. And the other issue with this is that it makes a difference to the legal cases that might pursue. If it was a hacker, it is then illegally obtained information, which is, of course, what one of the excuses Jones came out with first. Oh, well, you can't believe this. It's been illegally obtained. Well, sorry, The fact it's obtained illegally doesn't change the content.
Right.
But it does in terms of admissibility in a court. And in the UK, if material is obtained illegally, it is not admissible in a court. However, in the UK, and if that's where a trial would be held, if it's a whistleblower, somebody from inside who's released it, then it is admissible evidence. And I've got to say that, again, from my experience and the content of this, it appears to be somebody inside. It appears to be somebody who just finally got a level of conscience where, no, I can't let this go on. I can't let Copenhagen go ahead, and I think its release is not coincidental with that. And also, the emails that were selected out and the data that was selected out, now it is huge because it was a 61 megabyte file, but that's in a compressed version. The original is actually 127 megabytes, as I understand. And as I said, for a hacker to do that, they've got to be the most clever person in the world. So those are some of the issues that relate to the source of this information.
Yes, I want to get into some of the examples later on as well, see if there's anything more that has come to light in the last couple of days here. But first, I want to ask you what you consider to be, I guess, worst with all of this. Do you think it's all the money now that has been funneled to different climate change organizations, or is it simply basically how global policy have been changed over the years? And we see this emergence of all the nations coming together now under the guise of climate change in order to tackle this issue. But now it seems to be a moot point. There's nothing behind it. What do you think, Tim?
Well, exactly. And that's the question, of course, that that I gave five presentations last week in Alberta. And the last two were after the files had been released. And I just very quickly explained to the audience. And of course, the first question that comes up is inferred in what you've asked. What's the motive behind this? And, of course, I've followed that and written about that. And it's very easy to say, well, it's the money. I think people like Rush Limbaugh, the American right-wing commentator, says, well, you want the answers, follow the money. That is true up to a point. And certainly when you look at the but I think it's after the point, because certainly the amount of money that has been poured into the funding and the research and then spent on creating this monster of climate change and energy policies has created, for example, most of the money from governments funding only went to those people that were proving the theory, not disproving the theory, as is the proper scientific approach. So it's created a life of its own. And certainly that was achieved with money. For example, there's an article that shows that in the U.S., the U.S. government spent $70 billion in 1 year on this whole issue. But it goes back before that. And I think there's a quote from Lord Acton, who was a British politician at the beginning of the 20th century. And he said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And from what I have followed on this throughout my career, and you got to remember it started when global cooling was the consensus, and many of these people were involved in that. It is a coming together, and I mean, a lot of people say, oh, you know, you're just a conspiracy theorist. Well, sorry, there are conspiracies.
That's right.
And it what happens. And again, a kind of a simplistic analogy, but I think very appropriate. Sometimes couples, in most cases, two people get together and they reinforce the good things in each other. But every once in a while, a couple get together who reinforce the bad in each other. And you see this in the crimes between when a man and a woman. I mean, the case in England of the couple that were killing children and killed their own, you know, their own daughters and so on. And we had it in Canada with a case. And so every once in a while this happens. And it sort of becomes unholy alliances, as it's referred to. And what happened was that Maurice Strong, who is at the very heart of the politics of this issue, made a state. He's part of the Club of Rome.
Yes.
And the push for one world government. And in the second report, after their report on limits to growth, which came out with the whole idea that we're going to run out of everything and we're destroying the world and so on, they came out their second report in which they said, we have to get people's attention on this, even if it means creating false information, and global warming is a good vehicle to do that. And that's in their second report, after limits to growth. Now, Mara Strong then made a statement, which is reported, covered very well, in a book called A Cloak of Green by Elaine Dewar, a Canadian journalist, one with great integrity, because she started out to write the book, Cloak of Green, to praise the environmentalists, the Canadian environmentalists. But as she did her research, she found that these people were more corrupt, more devious than the corporations and people they were attacking. And one of them, of course, was Mara Strong, and she has 20% of her book devoted to it. He made the statement about 30 years ago that the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? And when Dewar asked him about that, she said, well, if you felt so strongly about this, why didn't you run for politics? His response was, you can't do anything as a politician. Now, that's probably the only honest statement he's ever made. But he then set about, with his incredible charm and enormous gifts for establishing and organizing systems and bureaucracies. And by the way, one of the things that I've consistently tried to do is acknowledge the talents that these people have. For example, Al Gore's movie, Inconvenient Truth, is a superb piece of propaganda.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. It's propaganda. And so, of course, what Mara Strong was doing is what happens so often with, evil people. Mm. They have talents. I mean, Hitler had talents, but it's a matter of how you use those talents.
Yes.
And so Strong, his response was, I'm going to go to the UN because there I can get all the money I want and not be accountable to anybody. And an illustration of what he did that is now trying to be done to the world to destroy the Western economies was he was appointed the chairman of Ontario Hydro. Now, this is a public utility in the province of Ontario, Canada. And he set up strategies which essentially meant that they were not replacing nuclear power stations, they were not replacing coal-burning power stations, and they were putting up wind farms that were totally useless, to the extent that Ontarians now pay a fee on top of their monthly energy bill that is referred to as the Strong Tax, and it's to cover the losses that he created. And that province is going to be in severe energy shortages for the next 40 years. And, of course, that was Strong's objective. Now, I want the listeners to think about how would you go about shutting down the industrialized nations? But before I do that, I want them to think about, in that great complexity that is the weather. So when you stand outside and experience the weather, you're experiencing what scientists call white noise. It is the sum total of individual red noises. So it's as if you were standing outside of a football stadium with 200,000 people. You hear the roar. That's the white noise. But it is made up of the individual voices of each person in that stadium who are the red noises. Mm. That's an analogy for weather. And then, so of course, the weather event includes everything from cosmic radiation in deep space to orbits of the sun around the Milky Way to cosmic radiation, right down to heat coming off the bottom of the oceans and everything in between. So to focus on one minute fraction of that, which is CO2, and it's an illustration of how small it is that most people don't know that CO2 is less than 4% of the total greenhouse gases, yet it has become the focus. That is an absolutely telling analogy of what's gone on.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you think about Quebec to strong now, his industrialized nations. And again, it's a good analogy to say those industrialized nations are the equivalent of the engine in a car. And the analogy is very good because they're both effectively running on fossil fuels. If you want to shut down the engine, you can squeeze off the energy supply, stop the fuel line, whatever. And the car will stop. If you did that in a nation, then the public would scream immediately. The impact would be immediate and devastating. And we saw that recently when the fuel prices went through the roof and everybody was out there screaming it immediately. Mm. However, you can stop an engine by plugging the exhaust or the muffler. And
And that's what's being done now, right? It's being muffled.
Oh, exactly. So, if you can show then that CO2, the byproduct of this nasty, evil engine, which is the industry, is causing the end of the world to come about, that the sky is falling and so on, then you can make, that's why it became the focus. Now, Strawn, of course, as a politician, could deal with setting up the political side of it. But he needed scientists to provide him with that ammunition. Mm. And that's where the CRU came in to play. And another story that resonates in all nations, I have chaired commissions of inquiry. I've sat on commissions of inquiry. And I learned the minute I was asked to chair one, or no, it was even before that, when I was appointed to one, we were asked to look at problems on a particular lake in Canada, and there was conflict over it, as there always is, over water resources. And, of course, the politicians, first of all, they want to step aside from conflict, but they also need escape vehicles. And commissions of inquiry are perfect escape vehicles for politicians. Now, you can say, well, okay, they come out and they say, well, we're going to have a commission of inquiry and we're going to appoint somebody and it'll be arm's length from the government and it'll be well investigated. And when the commission reports, we'll present their findings and so on. And you say, well, oh, very good. How honorable. And, of course, the politician can then defer any questions from the media or anybody else. Oh, I can't comment till the commission report comes in. I learned immediately with the very first one I was involved with that the way they control the commission is that they and their bureaucrats write the terms of reference. In other words, they limit what can be looked at and what conclusions can be reached. Mm-hmm. And so the first time, as I said, that I was involved, I told the chairman, go back to the minister and tell him that I will not, we can't even begin to look at the issue, let alone resolve it, with those terms of reference. And you can tell the minister that I'm prepared to go to the media and say, look, they've appointed us, but they've tied our hands. The minister clearly quickly saw that that was a greater threat to his political standing than yielding to us on the terms of reference. And I can tell you that within a few months, we resolved the problem that had been kicking around for 100 years, and so as I said, when you look at what Strong did, he went to the United Nations, he immediately set up the United Nations Environment Program, and within that and out of that, he set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he orchestrated the terms of reference for the IPCC. Mm. Now, one of those was the definition of climate change. The definition that the IPCC have to work with restricts them to only looking at those causes of climate change caused by humans.
Yes.
In other words, you virtually eliminate them looking at natural causes. And, of course, as I've tried to point out all along, you can't possibly identify the human fraction, especially because it's so small, unless you know how nature changes and the mechanisms that cause that.
Yes.
And, of course, we're far from knowing that. And then the most devastating term of reference that Strong built into the IPCC was they established three groups, working groups. Working group one was the science report, and then the two and three were the impact and amelioration groups. The second two, of course, simply have to assume what working group one says is the truth and then work from that. But they also established the summary for policymakers group. This group is made up of politicians and bureaucrats who are not part of either working group one, working group two, or working group three. However, there are two or three scientists who advise them on what has gone on in the other groups. The CRU people, including Phil Jones, including Michael Mann, including part of that group, but outside of CRU, Stephen Schneider, made sure that they were always in control of the information that went to that summary for policymakers. Mm. Now, the rules written by Strong and his gang say that the summary for policymakers is written separate from the rest. It is then released to the media, and the summary for the policymakers goes back to the scientist who wrote the technical or science report with the instructions saying, make sure that your report agrees with the summary that we've released.
Mm.
This is like an executive of a corporation writing a summary and then telling the employees to write a report that agrees with the summary that have already been reached.
Yeah.
It is the most outrageous thing, and there it is in their rules in black and white. And of course, the very first IPCC report that came out in 1995, there was a scandal immediately because the lead author of Chapter 8 is Benjamin Santer, who is both a graduate of CRU and now has gone from CRU to Lawrence Livermore Laboratories in the U.S., probably with the help of Tom Wigley, and we'll talk about him. And Santer changed the wording in Chapter 8, and it went out, and he changed it without advising or without the approval of the other authors of the chapter. When they found out, they were furious. And Professor Seitz, S-E-I-T-Z, who was president of the National Academy of Sciences, said this is an absolute outrage. And as I said, you can simply Google Chapter 8 scandal, and up it comes. That was the very first scandal. But, of course, this was also new, and it wasn't in the media eye, and it just drifted away. But there was some of the very clear signals all along that people like myself who were involved in this knew what was going on.
Hmm. I want to ask you if you know that basically if this means also that Professor Phil Jones and of the CRU and maybe some of his colleagues are in on the agenda of Maurice Strong and the Club of Rome. Is there, for example, is there anything suggesting that connection in the emails that have been released that you know of, Tim?
No, there's nothing that suggests that. I think that the connection is, and this is pure, I'm not going to speculate, but political agendas of these people, the connection with Strong is through government agencies, and I'm sad to say Strong is a Canadian, by the way, who came from a family in on the prairies in Western Canada, which was an area of extreme hardship in the 1930s. So that there was a party called the CCF party that was on the verge of being communist. So the whole region had a history of and some of it legitimate. I mean, these people were really suffering, and so and they were blaming industry and so on.
Mm.
Okay, so Strong came out of a family that was very, very strong socialist to the point of being communist. That was his upbringing. And I've talked to people who, one, for example, who went to school with him. And he said even in school he was not popular because of his views and his approaches and everything else. And I also talked to a lot of people that worked with him. But Strong used Environment Canada, and particularly an assistant deputy minister by the name of Gordon McBean. And Gordon McBean chaired the first meeting in which the IPCC was going to be established in Villach, Austria in 1985. And at that meeting, present at that meeting, were Phil Jones, Tom Wigley, Sayakuru Manabe, who was, of course, the computer modeler whose models are the basis of the IPCC models, and also Bert Bolin, who, of course, is well known to Scandinavians and his involvement. And so, and then following that 1985 Villach, Austria meeting, there was a meeting there in 1988 in which the IPCC was formally established. So that is how the connection came about. And when you look at the people and the emails at CRU, all of the names that show up consistently in all of the IPCC reports from 1995 on and right up to the most recent report in 2007, there they are, Carl, Trenberth, Mann, Santer, Jones, Wigley, and so on. And they're always in control of key chapters in those reports. The control of the summary for policymakers, but particularly the chapter on atmospheric components, which of course is the CO2 chapter, and the chapter on the computer models. And Andrew Weaver, who was the lead author of that, and also the editor of the Journal of Climate, through which they published some of their peer-reviewed, quote-unquote, stuff, and other people. So that's how Strong achieved that connection.
Yes.
Of course, so that was the science side. So the CRU provided the science that Strong needed to support his political agenda. Okay? Strong then took political agenda, now supported by the science, into the public arena because he organized the 1992 Rio conference.
Yes.
At which he invited all of the environmental groups and the NGOs, and at which Kyoto was first mapped out. And so CRU, IPCC covered the scientific part of the issue. The Rio conference covered the popular and public side of the issue. And so this is how Strong strung it all together.
I see. And what about if we go into some of the examples of information that you and others have stumbled over in the emails? I know that one of the issue, for instance, was how to efficiently kind of get rid of the medieval period, right?
Yes. Well, the one of the things was that, and it's very interesting because, and I want to give a kudo here, because the founder of the CRU was a fellow by the name of Hubert Lamb. Lamb was a meteorologist who worked in the weather office in England during the war, and was quite concerned as a good professional scientist about complaints from the pilots that the weather forecasts that they were giving over Europe were just atrocious. And Lamb decided that the best way to improve forecasting was to try and understand previous weather, and then from that you could determine the mechanisms and therefore forecast better. And so in his graveyard shifts, he dug through the archives of the weather office and, of course, discovered very quickly how much climate changes, how significant those changes were in human history and evolution. So he really became, and I think quite correctly, is considered the father of modern historical climate and modern climatology. The Greeks knew about it. In fact, the word climate comes from the Greek klimat, which means angle, and they were talking about the angle of the sun. But it's not till Lamb that it comes back into the general arena. Lamb wanted to set up a research unit to try and to look at, reconstruct history, climate of the past. The people at the weather office didn't want to, they were wasting their time. Lamb left, and then he made the great mistake in Britain, which is unfortunately, especially on the left, extremely anti-American. Now, that's not, some of that's justified, but not all of it. And he, they couldn't get funding, so he got American funding, which of course then put him even further on the outside. he set up the climate research unit at East Anglia. And my first contact with him was that when I was doing my doctoral thesis at Queen Mary College at the University of London, my supervisor, Bruce Atkinson, who, by the way, has done a lot of studies on urban heat island effect, and that's another part of this issue, he arranged a meeting for me with Lam, and we talked at length about my doctoral thesis and about climate science. And in fact, I also had the privilege that he peer-reviewed one of my articles for Climatic Change, which was then about the only journal on climate at the time. So Lam would be absolutely mortified. But in his autobiography of his life, he talks about how he wasn't familiar with the science side that was needed, particularly the computer models, and he hired a fellow by the name of Tom Wigley. And the only comment that Lam makes in his book is very cryptic, and actually quite gentlemanly in that, you know, classic English tradition, where he said that there was a conflict between Wigley and I. Wigley, of course, was already planning to take over the CRU at that time. And that's the background of the CRU. I've lost track of your original question. Was about, I know what it was, the medieval warm period.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, sorry. It's so much, it almost overwhelms my brain here.
I know.
it's easily overwhelmed. But anyway, Lam produced a temperature graph of temperatures in Europe over the last 1,000 years. And that graph appeared in the first IPCC report. And by the way, another example of the cover-up is if you go to the IPCC webpage, you cannot access the first and second reports anymore. They're gone off of the IPCC. Why, I don't know. I think because they hold some devastating information. But anyway, that graph that Lam produced appeared in that first report. And it showed how the medieval warm period that, and Lam and I talked about this at the time, about, you know, how long did it last, what defined the beginning and the end of it. It shows that that was warmer than the current temperatures. And of course, one of the issues that Jones and the whole gang have tried to push is that the latter part of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century are the warmest temperatures ever. And so, of course, people like myself and Richard Lindzen and some of the other so-called skeptics or deniers were writing and saying, hang on a minute, do you really mean ever? It was warmer just 1,000 years ago. And one of the most telling events that, again, was missed by the mainstream media and by a lot of people because they didn't understand the significance of it, was that Professor Deming, David Deming, wrote an article that was published in Science in 1995. And he got an email, and he says, I got this email from somebody who clearly thought I was part of the group that were trying to use climate science to achieve social and political change. And the person who, and he doesn't name the person, but we now know it was Jonathan Overpeck, who is part of the emails and the CRU gang. Overpeck says to him, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period.
Yeah.
Now, this is a blunt statement saying we've got to change the historic record. Okay? And, of course, they achieved that through the hockey stick. That was the purpose of the hockey stick, was to get rid of the medieval warm period. Now, fortunately, and again, you know, science works most effectively by serendipity, and I love that English word, just by happenstance, by chance. Steve McIntyre, who's a statistician whose career was looking at graphs and claims of mineral deposits in the geological field. And of course, the corruption and the chances for corruption in that, because there's so much money involved, are great. And McIntyre developed these skills to the point where he could look at a graph and knew that there was something wrong with it. And of course, the minute he saw the hockey stick graph, he not only knew what was wrong with it, but he knew how it had been achieved statistically. Hmm. And of course, at that point, he wrote to Michael Mann and asked for the code and the data.
Yeah.
You know, how did you do this? And of course, Mann immediately refused to provide it, and he does to this day.
Yeah.
But McIntyre's skill was such that he was able to work back from the graph and other minor sources of data to reconstruct what had actually happened. And of course, he then produced the new graph, and suddenly, magically, the medieval warm period reappeared. And so that was really the major breakthrough. And of course, you can argue that, as with all of these scandals, like with Watergate, the real scandal is not, it is, I guess, in originally what you did, but then it's your culpability is underlined by the cover-up. And, of course, it's the cover-up by Michael Mann and their refusal to disclose. Now, just one point I'll make with this, because the two points that have been made consistently to argue that humans are causing global warming is, one is the hockey stick graph.
Yep.
And Mann, by the way, was part of the group that helped write the summary for policymakers in the 2001. And so that graph appears five times in that 2001 report. It became the centerpiece because Mann was controlling the summary for policymakers that went to the media. But the other piece of information was that the temperature had increased by 0.6 degrees Celsius in approximately, well, since the end of the 19th century. That number came from Phil Jones.
Hmm.
Okay?
Hmm.
Now, Jones, and one of the things, by the way, that was the giveaway that I noticed but nobody wanted to listen to was that Jones put out this figure, and it said there's an increase of 0.6 degrees Celsius, approximately 1 degree Fahrenheit, but the range on it was plus or minus 0.2.
Hmm.
In other words, right. In other words, there was a 66% error factor in that number.
Oh, jeez.
But of course, okay. But of course, the public didn't understand that. The media never saw that.
Mm.
And Jones knew this. He knew that they would focus on, oh, well, this is. And of course, he then distracted them even more by saying, well, this is a more rapid increase than it could occur naturally. Therefore, it has to be human. Okay.
Mm.
That was the second. You know, most important point that they were trying to make. Now, when Warwick Hughes, an Australian researcher who had been looking at all of the data and the climate records and was putting out some of his problems on that wonderful site that was started by John Daly, who and basically they cheer his death in the email.
Yes, that's right. Sheesh.
Yeah. Okay, and I had the privilege of corresponding with John, and in fact he published two or three pieces of mine, and it was called "Still Waiting for Greenhouse," and the questions came up about this 0.6 number, but so Warwick Hughes, who was the Australian guy, emailed to Jones and said, "Look, how did you come up with this number? How did you adjust the data? Which stations did you choose to get it?" Jones came back with a devastating email in which he said, why should I give this data to you? It represents 25 years of work, and all you want to do is find fault with it.
Hmm.
And that's from Jones. And Jones refuses still to this day to disclose that information.
Yeah.
And so here we have the two most critical parts of the 2001 IPCC report, which then became the foundation of all governments throughout the world. Every one of them cites the IPCC 2001 report as their authority for what they're doing at Copenhagen and on climate change and on energy all of the cap and trade and so on.
It's a one-man conspiracy right there then, you know?
Oh, yes. But, and of course, the person at the center of it is Tom Wigley.
Mm.
And here's the interesting thing. Wigley not only took over from Lamb But he then became the bag man. There was a very good documentary put out as long ago as 1990 called The Greenhouse Conspiracy. And it's a very good documentary. In fact, it's as relevant today as it was in 1990. And it starts with, and it was done by Channel 4 of the UK. It's available on Google and YouTube. Or you can go to the friendsofscience.org website, and under the videos, it's listed there. And the premise is they show this Greek theater, or Greek temple, with its lovely Ionian columns. And there are four columns, and they represent the pillars of the greenhouse argument. And what they do through the program is they take, okay, here's the first pillar, the data. And then they show you what's wrong with the data, why it's wrong, and so on. And, of course, by the last pillar, it collapses, and the whole temple collapses. Now, this documentary was PBS refused to show it in the United States, said it was biased. David Suzuki, a virulent environmentalist in Canada, blocked it through his control of what the CBC were doing, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And so the thing really never got any airplay. And of course, it was so early in the game that the whole climate industry, and by the way, the industry of climate skeptics, because more and more have jumped on that bandwagon as well. Mm-hmm. And I've had to rein in a lot of the things they're doing and saying. And I saw it. I tried to get a copy, couldn't get one. And I was invited to a public utility in Canada and watched it in the boardroom with the management of this public energy utility. And they wanted my comments on its credibility. Mm-hmm. And in that movie are all the people that you see today, Sherwood Idso, whose wonderful site, CO2 Science, and the people doing the Urban Heat Island studies and so on and so forth. And in the movie, here is Tom Wigley at the CRU. And Wigley, the question basically is saying to him, but, you know, your data is questionable. And Wigley's very, very almost embarrassed response and coy, clever response is, well, you know, I have a lot of graduate students that I have to get funding for.
Oh. Sheesh.
And I mean, it's the most telling little clip. I knew immediately what the significance of it was. And of course, Wigley then went on to, as I said, he appeared with Jones, who was one of his proteges. Santer was a graduate student there. He went on to Village in Austria. And of course, then he went into a much bigger and more lucrative field than even the CRU. He went to NCAR, which is the National Center for Atmospheric Research in the U.S., where he controlled funding and funded all of the American research and was working with Hansen, Michael Mann, and all these other people. And, of course, when you look at the emails, he is clearly acknowledged as the grandfather. He's the go-to guy. So, for example, when they have a question about something, there's somebody who's working on a report for the National Academy of Sciences, and they email to Wigley and say, well, you know, Tom, what do you think we should do about this? And he comes back with a whole list of suggestions, and he says at the end, he said, this is a bit hurried, but I hope it's helpful. And, of course, in June 19th of this year, 2009, they had a meeting at NCAR in Colorado, at which a lot of the people, including Phil Jones, appeared, and it was a symposium to celebrate the career of Tom Wigley. And of course, it's absolutely amazing that despite all of the attacks that were even going on by June and prior to the release of these emails, these people are still so introverted and involved and in denial that they're celebrating this great victory. And in fact, the president of the UCAR, which is the university committee that is looking after NCAR, mm-hmm. in an opening slide to the congratulations to Wigley, he writes that he says, I can find it here. The first part of the slide, and it's a PowerPoint slide, says the reply, in quotes, the reply by Wigley and Jones is a monument of obfuscation, irrelevance, and spite. And that's a quote from Stephen McIntyre and Ross McKittrick from October of 2005. Then this Rick Anthes, the president, has underneath it the following quote. He says, this doesn't sound like the Tom Wigley we know and love. What's going on here? Okay? And my only comment to that is, well, Mr. Anthes, the fatherly Tom Wigley fooled most of the world.
Oh,
you know? Gosh. And so, as I said, right up till June, they're meeting with each other, reinforcing each other. And, of course, in one of the first public forums of the hockey stick, where a Professor Wegman, and his report is really telling to read. And he was appointed to a committee to arbitrate over whether Mann and Bradley and Hughes were correct about the hockey stick, or whether McIntyre and McKittrick were correct. The public relations group for Climate Research Unit are saying, oh no, he supported Mann, but he didn't, in fact. And here's a quote from that report.
Yeah.
He says, based on the literature we have reviewed, there is no overarching consensus on the Mann-Bradley-Hughes 98-99, which, of course, is the hockey stick paper.
Uh-huh.
And then he goes on to say, this is the most incredible thing, in a science report on a scientific document, he says, as analyzed in our social network, there is a tightly knit group of individuals who passionately believe in their thesis. However, our perception is that this group has a self-reinforcing feedback mechanism, and moreover, the work has been sufficiently politicized that they can hardly reassess their public positions without losing credibility. And I mean, for a scientist to write that about another group, and of course he actually names names in the report. He identifies 42 scientists. All of them have published with Mann, and he then says, not only are they publishing together, but they're peer-reviewing each other's work. Now, the significance of that is that I realized about 20 years ago, and there's an old English saying from Shakespeare, from Macbeth, where it says, methinks he doth protest too much.
Mm.
In other words, you're hitting on somebody's guilt if they are excessive in their protestations of innocence.
Right.
And I said, why are they pushing the peer review issue?
Yeah.
And you saw that all the time on Real Climate. They would come along and say, well, it's not peer reviewed. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, now we know that they were in control of the peer review process.
Exactly.
And therefore, and they not only could control the peer review of their own work, but they could also prevent other articles being published because they could control the peer review work. So if an article got to an editor, they could get on the peer review or on the peer review and say, don't publish. And in fact, in one particular email, and Wigley's involved in this, a journal editor chose to publish. And in an email about this to Jones, Wigley says, and I'll pull it up and quote it directly, and this is from Bishop Hill's summary. It says, Mann has challenged the GRL, which is the Geophysical Review Letters editor-in-chief, over the publication. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about the publication of McIntyre's 2005 paper. So Michael Mann has challenged GRL editor-in-chief over the publication. Mann is concerned about the connections of the paper's editor, James Sayers, with UVirginia. And then in brackets, Hill says, does he mean Pat Michaels? Well, of course, that's exactly who he means, because that's where Patrick Michaels, who's viciously attacked as well, is. Tom Wigley says that if Sayers is a skeptic, they should go through official GRL channels to get him ousted. And in fact, that's what happened. Sayers was subsequently thrown out.
So they
not only peer reviewed and controlled the peer review of their own, but they peer reviewed, they controlled the peer review of other stuff. And so, as I said, the level of control is really quite remarkable.
It's just incredible. I mean, what a big scam. It's incredible, Tim. And for we can begin to round things up here on this on the next point I want to ask you, and then we can continue. I have so much more I want to ask you here in our second hour. But
sure.
Basically, do you know if Tom Wigley yet or Professor Phil Jones, again, who is at the heart of this, because it's his emails that have been released now, have any of these two people yet commented on the emails that you know of, Tim?
Yes, they have.
They have,
and of course, they their reactions are, as I said earlier, they're in complete denial. As I said, Jones's first response was, "Well, you can't believe any of this stuff because it was obtained illegally."
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and I'll give you just two quick quotes. Do you want to go to the break first, or do you want me to give the quotes now?
No, please give the quotes, and we'll break after that. Yes.
Okay. Rick Anthes, the UCAR president who made that thing at the glorification of Tom Wigley, his response was, emails by their nature are quickly and sometimes thoughtlessly written and therefore open to misinterpretation and misrepresentation. Hmm. He said, it's unfortunate that this illegal hacking and invasion of privacy has generated such headlines and bad will. It doesn't alter the fundamental scientific fact that emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are changing our climate.
Oh.
Well, that is what's called in philosophy the classic circular argument.
Yes.
Because the evidence that CO2 is and other greenhouse gases are changing our climate comes from CRU and IPCC. it just shows first of all how twisted these people are. But Wigley himself, his response in the same article, he picks a particularly devastating email from Jones. And he says, this email was directed to Phil Jones only, and Phil knew exactly what I was talking about. It does not at all refer to making some arbitrary correction to existing data in order to make such data fit some preconceived ideas about global warming. Well, of course, I mean, anybody with any ounce of sense reads it and says, no, that's exactly what it's saying, Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, what they're doing here is they're using the vehicle that has allowed them to get away with this all the way through. Michael Crichton wrote a book called State of Fear, in which he, it is based around how environmental groups use fear to get their message across and get the public scared and get the public on side and to divert attention from the facts. The interesting thing is that the climate science in that book, although it's presented as a novel, the climate science, which is fully footnoted and documented, is very accurate. I happen to know that Michael Crichton was a roommate with Richard Lindzen at Harvard. And Richard Lindzen, of course, is the preeminent, not only a skeptic, but atmospheric meteorologist at MIT,
mm-hmm.
On this issue, was a member of the IPCC initially, and then resigned because he just couldn't tolerate what was going on anymore.
Because he knew.
And, yeah.
Huh.
So you can see that was one side of it, was the fear.
Yeah.
The second side that they've used is they know the public don't understand not only science generally, but the climate science in particular,
yeah.
That they could make statements and that the mainstream media could pick them up because they were sensational. And it's also what the left-leaning mainstream wanted to hear. For example, one of the most devastating emails doesn't just involve the science people, but there are emails in there from Andrew Revkin, both to Jones and back to Revkin. And Revkin, of course, is the science writer for the New York Times.
Mm.
And so Revkin became the conduit. And the New York Times, of course, is the flagship of the liberal and left views of things, particularly in the U.S. And so Revkin is saying to Jones, well, you know, I've got a problem with this. How do we deal with it? And Jones is telling him. And then Revkin, they're sending emails to Repkin saying, look, you really should do something on this or write about that. I mean, Repkin's integrity as a journalist is finished. He's completely shot.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's just one of many. And of course, as I said, one of the things that's going on now is that they're with these denials and this comment by Wigley, is they're continuing to assume that they can get away with it because the public won't understand what they're talking about.
It's incredible. It's all about the manipulation of perception. And Tim, let's take a little break here, and then I want to get into. There's so much more to discuss, obviously, but I do want to get into the science bit of this a little bit as well, and from your perspective and the different things, and basically how this the science of global warming, how that is falling apart right now. But stay with us, Tim. And if there's any, by the way, are there any websites here that you want to get give out to our listeners right away so they know where to go, or if you have any material out there that you want to mention for people?
Yes, well, one of the sites that I helped set up, which of course has been viciously attacked, was friendsofscience.org. That's all one word, friendsofscience.org. There we tried to focus strictly on the science. And of course, we were accused of being paid by the oil companies and all the rest of it. But that gives you the science in a way that most people can understand. And that was done deliberately. I've written a lot of articles in a way that people can understand without belittling the science. And then there's another, I write about the connection between science and the politics of the issue, as to some extent as we're discussing here, on a site called CanadaFreePress.com. That's all one word, CanadaFreePress.com. And by the way, that website is a conservative in its approach website. And one of the telling things about this issue, and we can talk about this after, is that if you were in support of the humans causing warming theory, you were considered left-wing, and if you were opposed to it, you were considered right-wing. Oh. And there were an awful lot of scientists who were socialist and left-wing in their political ideology who didn't agree with it, but didn't want to say they didn't agree with it, because then they were immediately pigeonholed as right-wing. So those two sites are very good. Yeah. What's Up With That, which you've already identified, is excellent. Climate Audit has been having troubles with their server, but they've got a new server. It's a lot more technical and will be difficult for a lot of the people, but still they can get something out of it. The CO2 Science by Sherwood Itso, and that's the title of it, CO2 Science, all one word, .com. JunkScience.com, another good one. And I have already mentioned, you've mentioned the site where the raw data is available.
Yep.
If the audience don't want to go and wade through all the raw data, the Bishop's Hill, site, is the one that I referenced, that does a very, very good succinct summary of the critical points. And, I'll just give the URL for that.
I think it's bishophill.squarespace.com, right? Is that the one?
Yeah, that's the one. It's bishophill.squarespace.com. You're right.
We have plenty of website here to give out. I just want to reiterate these: friendsofscience.org, CanadaFreePress.com, climateaudit.org. We also have whatsupwiththat.com, co2science.com, junkscience.com, and finally then bishophill.squarespace.com. But no worries to all your listeners out there. We have this linked up on redasscreations.com, our website as well, so you can click through from our site easily and read so much more of this and what's how this basically is unfolding as we speak here, Tim.
Exactly. And each of those sites, of course, as is the beauty with the Internet, links you to other sites.
Exactly. Okay, Tim, stay with us. Thank you for this first hour. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with more after this. Join us for Hour 2 with Tim Ball as we discuss the Kyoto Protocol and how it's set to die in 2012. It's a failed treaty, and here's where the Copenhagen Climate Treaty comes in. We discuss COP15, the UN Climate Conference, in Copenhagen in greater detail. We also talk about how the raw climate data have been dumped. We discuss cap and trade, Al Gore, fraud, and the perceived consensus of the science behind global warming. We talk about the alleged disappearing polar bears, water vapor as a greenhouse gas, faulty computer models, sunspots, the precession cycle, insolation, and the effects of cosmic rays on cloud formation. A really important second hour that you don't want to miss coming up now for Red Ice members.